WPFW in Washington, and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features COP29, climate change, climate justice, and more. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show. I'm Muizo Muntali. The music in the background is Water No Get Enemy by Fela Kuti. First, I just want to take this opportunity to thank all of you for your support of WPFW and Africa Now during our recent fall pledge drive. If you're not able to make your pledge during that time, you can still do so anytime at wpfwfm.org. Go to the Donate Now button. And also you can go to our Cash App, which is the $WPFWFM. Together, we can build a better world one broadcast at a time. This week, the UN Climate Change Conference began in Baku, Azerbaijan. The conference is scheduled from November 11 to November 22nd, and it is the 29th annual meeting of the Conference of the Parties, or COP29. Of the 1992 UN Climate Agreement, which is the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC. The agreement was put into force in 1994, 30 years ago this year. On the first day of the conference, the World Meteorological Organization, WMO, noted that 2024 is on track to be the hottest year on record. In its press release, the World Meteorological Organization's State of the Climate 2024 update on November 11, 2024, the WMO states that 2015 to 2024 will be the warmest 10 years on record. The loss of ice from glaciers, sea level rise, and ocean heating are accelerating, and extreme weather is wreaking havoc on communities and economies across the world. Yesterday, I had a conversation with activist Mohamed Lamine Sadja Khan, head of Building Power Department at the Climate Action Network International. Mohamed Lamine Sadja Khan is currently at the climate conference in Baku. In the conversation, he unpacks past commitments made and missed by the Global North in addressing its role in exacerbating climate change, assistance to the Global South in alleviating the impact of climate change, demands at COP29 from the Global South, the role of civic society, impact of the fossil fuel industry, and more. Here is the conversation. Mohamed Lamine Sadja Khan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to join this important critical discussion right now.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule. And you're right there in the midst of COP29 in Baku, Azerbaijan. Before we get into the specifics of the topic, I wanted you to, if you could give us a broad overview and of the COP29, what COP is. Yeah, and we'll start from there.
All right, thank you so much. To start with, COP is the United Nations Climate Conference, what we call, it's normally called the climate talks, that are held annually by countries or parties that have signed up to the UNFCCC agreement, looking into countries' commitments and countries' deliberation on key issues that will address the climate crisis that the world is faced with. It have been many years since world leaders realized that when we talk about climate change, there is no separation between countries. Everybody is affected by the climate crisis and then the effects of climate change. We have been witnessing serious heat waves everywhere in many parts of the world. We have been witnessing drought. We have been witnessing flood. We have been witnessing wildfires that are affecting, you know, communities and affecting environment, the ecosystem across the world. So that is why it is critical for leaders across the world in all the countries that are signed up to this UNFCCC climate agreement, which is known as the Paris Agreement as well. In the recent discussions, they have agreed on critical commitments in Paris. As we come to Baku, the same commitments and talks continue. Every year, one country will host and looking at the different areas. But as we speak right now, the world is at a critical road, because by 2030, we will determine by ourselves whether we are going to meet the 1.5 degrees target, that is keeping the temperature at that level or lower than that, or are we going to leave ourselves to go beyond 1.5, because science have told us that if we go above 1.5 degrees, many of the humanity might not live to witness the crisis that will be on humanity, because the climate crisis will be so hard on life and livelihood, including the life of humans. So that's why it's critical. It's everybody's business, everybody's business in this world, that we all need to collectively, governments, communities, businesses, all need to collectively come together to tackle the climate crisis by talking together, by finding solutions together. And that's what the COP is all about.
And when you said 1.5 degrees, that's 1.5 degrees Celsius.
Yes.
For those of us here in the U.S., and that's 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit above the pre-industrial average. That's what you were mentioning. And that was actually the report that was just released last week on November 7th, which talked about that. So as we look at that, and as we look at the storms and the heat waves that are taking place due to their natural disaster, but really exacerbated, accelerated, and increased by the human action, how is the atmosphere? What is the mood like in Baku as you are preparing to go into the conference full speed ahead?
Yeah, we are back again in another petrol state, I'll call it. You know, Baku or Azerbaijan is another petrol state. The past three COPs have been held in closed doors, I will call it, because there is no open space for civil society to protest or do open street demonstrations. So everything have to be done in a closed door. Last year, we were in Dubai, which is a petrol state. Baku also depend on coal, oil and gas. So it's like Azerbaijan. So it is clear that this particular COP really need to build on the gains from our last year's COP engagement. Last year, we agreed, or the world leaders have agreed, on the first time in history on the language, first time to be mentioned, that we need to end fossil fuel extraction. Science, that is the IPCC, have indicated and communicated to the world clearly that 80% of the cause of the climate crisis is the burning of the fossil fuels, either being a gas, coal, or oil. Extractions are the major cause of fossil fuel. So last year, world leaders have made a commitment to saying they want to end the fossil fuel extraction. But that is just a language, because there is no commitment around equitable phase out. Well, what that means is, you know, you cannot tell US and Europe to phase out at the same time with countries like Malawi or countries like Senegal that are just starting extraction. So that equitable phase out, who should start first, is critical as we go into Baku climate talks. The UN, world leaders have made commitments during the Copenhagen climate talks that they will commit $100 billion annually into climate finance. These commitments have not been fulfilled. They have not been met. Now we are looking at what we call NCQG, the new collective quantified goals on climate finance. That's why this COP is critical. That's why it becomes a very important COP, because it's talking about finance, the new goal, the new collective quantified goal on climate finance. Now, the civil society is asking for global north countries to pay the debt that they owe, the climate debt that they owe to global south, which is estimated as about $5 trillion. The global south countries like Africa are demanding for a minimum of $1.3 trillion grant-based finance. That is not loan, that is not debt, but it has to be grant-based. And the civil society in general, again, are asking for minimum of $1 trillion to be paid as grant-based finance. That is not debt, that is not loan, but it's paid to, you know, global south to address the climate crisis, the urgent need for climate crisis. Without finance, we don't see any way of addressing climate finance or climate crisis in general. Again, the global goal on adaptation is also a big thing, big issue. Developing world or global south, you know, are struggling to adapt on the climate crisis, to adapt to climate crisis. The crisis that they have not caused historically been caused by the activities, human activities of the global north, the burning of the fossil fuel industry, the fossil fuel, but again, the industrialization that are causing more harm. Last year, again, we have witnessed and pushed the world leaders to come up with an agreement on the loss and damage fund that have been pushed for a very long time. And then the fund is now agreed to be established. A board have been in place, and executive director have been appointed. But there is empty pot that is almost in place. Richer countries need to put money into this. Last year we saw UAE and others pledging some money into this pot. But richer nations like US, you know, Europe as a collective, Canada and others, they all have to put money into this. They all have to put money into this so that the loss and damage fund can really reach the communities that are living with the crisis. I want to point out to say that the World Bank is the host of the loss and damage fund. But, you know, the mechanism that will make this fund more accessible should be looked into more, because the mechanism that World Bank have, if they want to apply the same mechanisms, communities and civil society groups will not have access to these funds, and they are directly dealing with you know, communities that are living the brunt of the climate, that are living the brunt of the climate crisis. I'll give an example. Last year, Mozambique had a big climate catastrophe. They had to borrow money to respond to flood from World Bank in responding to flood. So the loss and damage funds, if it is in place, countries like Mozambique, right now Senegal is faced with a big submerge of, you know, houses, submerge of food crops, because of heavy floods that the Sahel region is dealing with. Who is going to respond? The governments have to respond. But where is the money coming from? The money needs to come from the global north into the loss and damage fund, so that, you know, countries will be able to respond, because people are living with the crisis, the brunt, the cost of the climate crisis that they have not caused. So all of this, as I mentioned, I'm just mentioning a few, just transition discussions will are ongoing. All of these are things that are happening in Baku today. And from today down to the next 3 days, leaders across the world will be discussing, you know, critical issues and critical topics around how we jointly address the climate crisis, but finance at the center of all of it.
And again, that's Mohamed Lamine Sajekan. He's head of Building Power Department at the Climate Action Network, CAN International. That's Climate Action Network International. And we are looking at COP29. That is the conference of the parties of the convention, the convention of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, adopted in 1992 and put in force in 1994. And we're looking at climate change, climate justice, and more. As I wanted to unpack several things that you have said in that great summary, so this, we'll unpack it so that people have a clear understanding some of the things that you mentioned. First of all, I just want to start because you had mentioned this is the third conference that's really taking place in a fossil fuel based country, a country that's a fossil fuel producing country before. And some of the critics and activists, people like Greta Thunberg, have criticized COP29 taking place in another fossil fuel producing country, and have called this a greenwash conference. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think I will agree with that, Ms. Claire, that we will see countries are hosting this this conference when they are one of the contributors to the crisis, because they are producing fossil fuel, and fossil fuel has been clearly stated and analyzed by science that the fossil fuel extraction is the major responsible of the climate crisis. So world leaders need to set examples and take the cup to countries that are showing example, countries like Colombia, that have now, you know, clearly said that they are moving out of fossil fuel production. They want to go into 100% renewable, and they have set targets for themselves. Countries like Ecuador, you know, that have really made commitments to moving out of fossil fuel and non-fossil fuel extractions. When you go to the Pacific region, a lot of countries have said, make the same commitment. They have signed to the fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty, you know. So those are examples. But we continue to see COP being hosted in countries. And when you talk about greenwashing, again, what we've seen in these COPs, when you go to the stores and the pavilions, you see, you know, nuclear being promoted. You see a lot of false solutions being promoted, like carbon markets. One of the carbon markets initiatives that have been promoted across Africa, that is, you know, buying forests of different communities of different countries and giving licensing to fossil fuel companies to continue to pollute. And what is this causing the environment and the people is that they don't have access to do the human activities in this forest. So if government sold your forest for 50 years or 10 years, that allows the fossil fuel company in a particular global north country or a fossil fuel producing country, then the community is denied of access to this forest for a long period of time. And that money that comes is said to be a development support, development financing. But again, the giving is giving licensing to a fossil fuel company to continue to pollute. And at the end of the day, we are all going to live the brunt of the climate crisis, because as they burn and extract the fossil fuel, it continues to cause more disasters, and it continues to affect the climate much more, and continue to expose humanity and Earth to the crisis as we go. So that's why I support the pronouncement that having crop in a petrol state is a form of greenwashing.
And so this really shows the power of the fossil fuel industry to shape and control the agenda of the COP conferences. Because as you mentioned before, the goal of the last year's COP28 in Dubai was transition away from fossil fuels. And how much of that has been reached?
Yeah, they just did the mayor talk, making pronouncement to say, oh, we're gonna end fossil fuels. But no step have been taken, no commitment have been taken to see how this will be done. No finance pronouncement have been done, no mechanism have been thought through. How will it be done equitably? But no commitment have been said on how justice will be applied across in all of this. So a mere language of, oh, we're gonna transition from fossil fuels without the how. It's just a mere talk. We're hoping that this particular COP will definitely define what that means. We'll tell us how it will be financed. We'll tell us how countries who even have the potential of extracting fossil fuels will be supported with an alternative development financing so that they will not extract their fossil products or their fossil minerals. They will go into, you know, more other alternative development financing, because when a country have oil or gas, or coal in Africa or in global South country, in Asia or Latin America or the Pacific, they will want to extract it so that they can fasten their development financing. But a richer nation ready to support these countries so that they will leave the fossil product in the ground and being supported by alternate development financing. So these are big questions that we have as civil society that we hope that, you know, richer nations will address. But again, communities that are listening to me, that are listening to these conversations, will push back on their leaders to say they have to keep the fossil on the ground. They have to keep the fossil in the ground in order to save humanity and Earth.
And as you mentioned in your summary of what was happening at COP29, was some of the issues that you should hopefully be raised. One of the things you mentioned of this COP, and also as people were talking about COP, they were labeling it as the finance COP. And if you could explain that a bit more about why is it being called the finance COP, particularly in the context of assisting lower-income countries reduce greenhouse emissions?
Yeah, as people might know, or those who are listening, or you might know, in order for us to implement the Paris Agreement, that have been very progressive agreements on key issues and key steps and policy steps that countries or parties have agreed to in order to meet the 1.5 degrees Celsius target, so that everybody will be safe to continue to live on this earth. That keeping it to 1.5 have to be financed. So later on, you know, the Copenhagen COP, Paris said, oh, the Global North can contribute $100 billion every year into addressing the gaps around climate finance. And this money will go to Global South so that they'll be supported with adaptation, they'll be supported with other climate financing needs to help countries to progress into meeting the Paris Agreement. But this particular commitment of 100 billion have failed woefully, as we have seen little progress and little support coming from the Global North to fulfill that commitment, and making a lot of flimsy excuses about why they are not contributing why they are not meeting the commitment. So we reach to a time, this particular COP, we reach to a time that parties need to evaluate and come up with new, you know, collective quantified goals on climate finance that will help the world to keep the temperature to 1.5 degrees by 2030. How much money should world leaders contribute, world richer nations contribute to help poorer nations and global south to give their part of, you know, commitment to keeping the world safe for everybody? And in that process, you know, a lot of debate and discourses have been made, and it have come to certain figures that the world leaders, in order for us to keep it the temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius, they should pay the debt that they owe, the climate debt they owe to the global south for burning fossil fuels, for destroying the outer layer of the environment, of the earth, for continuous industrialization that's affecting the ecosystems and the environment. They should pay $1.5 trillion annually as a debt that they owe to the global south. But again, the civil society is saying there should be a commitment from the global north to contribute at least $1 trillion annually. So a grant-based, granular contribution of $1 trillion to the global south for them to, you know, as their compensation, as their support to keep 1.5 C alive. Again, we have heard from countries like Africa, where I come from, continents like Africa, where I come from, they are demanding for a grant-based finance of 1.3 trillion to keep this 1.5 alive. So when you look at this all, it is critical for richer nations to really do this contribution, because if they don't do these contributions, they don't provide this financing, countries in the global south will not be able to adapt. And if bigger countries like India, bigger countries in Africa like Nigeria and others fail to, you know, transition or fail to have their finance, climate finance goals met, then the rest of the world, will continue to suffer. So that's why the financing is very, very critical, because it fastens the transition. It also helps countries to adapt.
And as you mentioned, the UN report actually recently said that emerging countries will need $2 trillion annually by 2030. But you're saying that 1.5 to halt global warming. Is that the same? Is that what you're talking about? The 1.5 per year. But the UN has been saying that the need is actually $2 trillion. And do you think that will be achieved?
Yeah, that's what the UN UNEP report is saying, that the gap that is there is $2 trillion. That's what is needed in terms of financing. When you put those kind of figures to richer nations, they complain. They shout, "Oh, where are we going to get this money? We cannot have this money." You know, that's why for the immediate start of it, people are asking for at least 1.3 trillion for this COP to agree on. But again, when the broader civil society is demanding for 5 trillion, you know, as finance that is owned. That's owed by the developed world or the global south. So finance is at the center of everything when you talk about climate, because that's what helps with mitigation, that's what helps with adaptation, and that's finance help to address the immediate climate impacts.
Do you think that the recent weather disasters this year have made these demands by emerging countries more urgent, or let's put it this way, have given them a stronger hand for their demands to be met, because we now see all, you know, the floods in Spain, and of course recently, I'm not sure if it's directly related to climate change, but the wildfires in the Northeast and also in the Pacific Coast here in the United States, and other places as well, where it's directly impacting the global North. Do you see that also will help the hand of the global South in their demands for the funds that they've been pushing for so many years?
Yeah, no, it's evident. The impact of climate change is evident in all angles.
You're listening to a conversation that's unpacking the UN Climate Change Conference, which is taking place in Baku, Azerbaijan. The conference is scheduled from November 11 to November 22nd, and it is the 29th annual meeting of Conference of the Parties, or popularly known as COP29. The conversation features activist Mohamed Lamine Sajakan, head of the Building Power Department at the Climate Action Network International. And he is at the climate conference in Baku. The music in the background is Karima by Genoisa Marere. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
The heat waves are hitting Europe, they're hitting everybody. The floods in Spain are clinical examples that this climate crisis is real. The impact of climate crisis is real. As I was talking about earlier, in Senegal, there's a serious flood. Certain communities like Bakel have been submerged, many houses and food crops. When you go to the US, we've seen wildfires, not only in the US, but even in Canada in over the years. You know, Brazil, in the Amazon, there have been wildfires everywhere. These are not just human activities. These are caused by, you know, the inhuman activities that are now impacting on us, the inhuman activities of the climate that are now impacting on us. When there is too much of heat, you know, we see fire, forests got cut into fire, just like that. So the evidence is there in the eyes of everybody. World leaders have seen it clearly. Today, the UN Secretary General said, richer nations have to pay up in order to keep the world safe. It is critical for them to pay up the finance to Global South, to poorer countries, in order to keep the momentum and in order to keep the world safe. So the evidence is there in the eyes of every developed world, and citizens need to push their leaders to do the right thing by contributing to this critical new qualified collective finance accord.
And again, that's Mohamed Lamine Sajakan, who's head of Building Power Department at Climate Action Network International, and he's speaking to us directly from Baku in Azerbaijan, and that's where COP29 is taking place, the climate conference, the annual climate conference that's taking place. And we're looking at climate change, climate justice, and more, particularly focusing on the theme of this conference of COP29, looking at financing for the mitigating the climate change, the effects of climate change on the countries, and also climate adaptation for poorer countries. But as you mentioned, we're talking about the global climate finance that you've been talking about, that is really at the heart of this conference. This global climate pledge, which is the pledge, the 100 billion, expires this year. Do you see them at the end of this conference? Do you have activists like yourself? Do they have any hope, optimism that this will be strengthened. There'll be not just a pledge, but there'll be strong commitment at the end of this conference.
Yeah, great. This is what we are asking for. We are saying that, you know, we don't want just the figure. We don't just want the quantum. There's just a random figure to be said, to be announced. Like, that's what we did. That's what they did in the Copenhagen COP discussions. They said, oh, we're going to give $100 billion annually. But no commitment. The quality of the finance, that's what we are talking about. The funds have to be granular, annual contributions of trillions, not billions. We are not asking for billions anymore. We're asking for trillions to be put on the table, but to have mechanisms in place that will make this money accessible directly to poorer countries, but again, accessibly directly to communities, but also accessible to the civil society for us to collectively respond to the urgent need of, you know, the climate crisis that we are all dealing with. So that's why the finance have to be quality finance, granular finance, that is, you know, annual-based contributions that richer nations have to commit to.
And as you mentioned, the accessibility of the funds, earlier on we talked about the loss and damage fund, which is being housed at the World Bank. And you talked about how this is not accessible to grassroots organizations, people on the ground who are adversely affected by climate change. And you had specifically cited the example of Mozambique earlier on. If you could expand a bit more on the mechanisms of the fund. And right now the fund sits at about $700 billion, which is very small considering the amount of work that needs to be done. But if you could expand a bit more on the mechanisms of that fund, which is housed at the World Bank.
Yeah, so the World Bank is the host of the fund. They have a board that is overseeing the funds and the secretariat kind of created under the World Bank. They will make it operationalized next year, 2025. What civil society is demanding for is to have this fund accessible. It cannot be, you know, issued or distributed using the World Bank mechanisms that are more of debt trap. World Bank support countries with loans, you know, with debt, increasing debt, you know. This particular fund needs to be in a more accessible way, grant-based financing to countries, but also to communities can have direct access. The application process that allow communities that are affected by the climate crisis, that are living the brunt of the climate crisis, the impact of the climate crisis, to act to directly apply for this fund. But again, civil society that are supporting communities in response to climate crisis have also direct access, and community-based groups as well directly. So that's why the mechanism at World Bank need to be very flexible and need to be put in a way that communities can redirect. So the traditional way of World Bank giving funding and support to countries cannot be applied for this loss and damage fund.
And also one of the things you mentioned is the carbon markets, which if you could explain to us who don't go into the weeds of these issues all the time, if you could explain to exactly what the carbon market does, because when you were talking about it before, it very much doesn't seem to be transparent to the people, and also it almost looks like similar to how the trading patterns after independence, after we gained independence in the global south, we just continued the old colonial trading patterns, as we call them, neocolonial system. Is the carbon market structure as it stays structured today, is it something that perpetuates that neocolonial system, or is it something new that offers people in the global south a chance to have positive change?
Yeah, I think carbon markets and carbon trading in itself is a new way and a new form of polarization. Because countries are full in the way to sell their forests. So Global North companies and selling these forests to these Global North countries or fossil fuel producing, you know, companies is giving them license. You cannot make a funny calculation to say if you buy this particular number of forest land, you can continue to pollute. So it's kind of giving them license to continue to pollute. Like, it's very sad that countries like Zambia, countries like Liberia, Ghana, and others, and even Gambia and other places, they are all Kenya. They are all going into this carbon trading. Last year, during the Africa Climate Summit, African countries came together and have a deal with all of these European and US companies that are, and UAE and others, you know, agreeing that they will give their forest land to these companies so that they can continue to pollute with minimal amount of money that is given. Some countries have given up to 10% of their forest land to these companies. And what that is doing to communities is that communities will not have access to this forest within the time, within the period that is agreed with these companies. So it's a new form of colonization. So it's a new form of giving your wealth and resources, because communities use this forest as an adaptation mechanism, because they go into the forest, pick wild fruits, eat them when they're hit by hunger caused by climate crisis. But when you sell your forest into carbon trading or in the carbon market, you cannot access, you cannot touch this forest, you cannot access them because you don't own them anymore. They are owned by the Global North countries. They are owned by the Global North companies. So it's a new form of colonization. I hope, you know, more people talk about this so that countries will see the impact of selling their forests, because it's so bad. The Global North companies and industries need to be taxed for producing fossil fuels. That's what we are demanding for. We are demanding for all the fossil fuel companies to pay tax for producing fossil fuel. And this money will be a new form of finance that supports the Global South as well.
So under that market system, there isn't a system where the Global North companies are supporting Global South countries in, let's say, reforestation, for instance.
Yeah, that's what they said to me. They said, okay, if we buy your forest, we will support reforestation of this forest. Yeah, that's going to happen. Gradually, hopefully, going to happen. But they will not stop their fossil fuel production. They will continue to produce more. In fact, increase their production because of buying a forest land in Zambia or in Malawi. And they will continue. For them, they will continue to produce more fossil fuel in UAE. They will continue to produce more fuel in the US. Continue to produce more fuel, fossil fuel in the UK. Continue to produce more fossil fuel in Australia or Canada. So that's what's happening. And which is really dangerous to everybody who lives on Earth, because the more burning of fossil fuels, the more closer we are to destruction of our life and livelihood, because there'll be more disasters, there'll be more climate impacts.
And again, that's Mohamed Lamine Sajid Khan. He's head of Building Power Department at the Climate Action Network International. And he's unpacking COP29, which is taking place in Baku in Azerbaijan. And he's speaking to us directly from Baku. And he's taking part in that conference as part of the civic society. And before we wrap up, I also wanted to touch on an issue that's in the background or in the shadows of the conference, and that's the role of major countries in the G20. You see them, apart from not making their commitments throughout this process, this year you don't see many heads of state at this process. For instance, the head of government here in the United States, President Biden, is not going to be there, and a number of other countries' leaders, Germany, is not going to be there. Do you see that also kind of sending a message that they are not going to take this process seriously?
Yeah, everybody is really worried because this year is a very critical COP. This COP is very critical because it's about finance. And where does finance lie? Where does finance sit? Finance sit with the G20. Finance sit with the richer nations. So if you don't have the leaders here, that means there's lesser commitment. That means the outcome might not be great. So, but we hope that their absence will not stop their countries fully giving much bigger commitment. Talking about US, everybody's worried about this following the elections of Donald Trump, who made categorically clear that he's not very much interested in climate, but also not interested in climate finance. You see it as US giving money out to countries. And the US is one of the countries that are more responsible of the climate crisis because they have historically been one of those countries that have polluted more through industrialization, but burning off fossil fuels. But again, countries like Germany and the rest of Europe have to pay the climate debt. They have contributed to the burning of fossil fuels more. The rest of the G20, they have been the major responsible of the climate crisis because they have historically been the major contributors to greenhouse emissions.
And also the role of, because, you know, historically the role of the U.S., in this conference, as one could say, at times it's been very ambiguous, and other countries, of course, has been very ambiguous because of the role of the industries, the fossil fuel industries involved in pushing their country, the U.S. in particular, and other northern countries. Do you think this also, by them being right now, we're seeing almost like okay, the leadership is not there. And also you're seeing the new administration, which will take over, has openly said that they don't like this process. Do you think that also helps the Global South to be in greater solidarity on the issue?
Yeah, the Global South have been always in greater solidarity. And they have always been the G77 and plus China. They have always been together in negotiations and always serve as a collective force, pushing on the global north and the U.S. But what people are saying is, with or without U.S., we will work together to save the world. So we hope that other world leaders, like in the G20, will, pay their fare or will give their fair commitment to contributing to the new collective quantified goal, that is NCQG. By coming up with contributions of trillions, not billions, but trillions, as we go into the Baku talks and as we reach to the last days of this COP. It is unfortunate that we cannot predict what US will definitely do in many of these climate talks. And that's why activist groups like CAN and others have been holding US so accountable to fulfill the commitments, but also make, their stance clear. So that's why in many instances and many of our tactics, we name and shame them when they're creating some strategies to block the progress of the negotiations, especially this year, when we talk about critically important, the main pillar of the fight against climate crisis, which is financing the transition from fossil fuels to renewable, but also financing adaptation, mitigation, and all the impact that we left with the loss and damage, financing as a critical part of dealing with climate crisis.
Lamine, thank you again for dissecting what you expect at COP29, And we look forward to having you again in a few weeks when COP is finished to give us an analysis of what was expected and what was the final outcome of COP29.
All right, thank you so much for having me. I hope to speak to you soon again after COP. We hope that the COP will deliver on its goals.
Yeah, thanks again for being on our show again.
All right, thank you for having me.
You've just been listening to a recent conversation with activist Mohamed Lamine Sajakhan, head of Building Power Department at the Climate Action Network International. Mohamed Lamine Sajakhan is currently at the climate conference in Baku. The UN Climate Change Conference began in Baku, Azerbaijan on November 11 and goes on to November 22nd this year. And it is the 29th annual meeting of Conference of the Parties of the 1992 UN Climate Agreement. The conference is properly known as COP29. You can revisit the conversation on African Now's SoundCloud page. That's African Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is Tomorrow by the Brothers Johnson, and that was produced by Quincy Jones in 1976. Quincy Jones joined the Ancestors last week on November 3rd. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shaanana with Zain Al-Amin looking at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, particularly the plight of Palestinians, which is followed by the women's collective Sophie's Parlor, and that's followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder, and that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Combit Lakai with Eugenia Charles looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nasella and Claire Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Kozer and Fonangonda, and our Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmi Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdison. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. And continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave with a closing song entitled Ubuntu by Sona Jobate. Have a great day, have a great week, and stay safe.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. President-elect Donald Trump last night named more people to fill key positions in his next administration. Tech billionaire and GOP donor Elon Musk and former presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy, himself a billionaire, were tapped to lead a new Department of Government Efficiency. Trump called the department the Manhattan Project of this era, which would bring, quote, drastic change by next summer. Before the election, Musk said he would help Trump trim $2 trillion from the federal budget without providing details. In a bizarre choice, Trump selected relatively unknown Fox News host Pete Hegseth to lead the Department of Defense. Hegseth is an Army National Guard officer and is best known for co-hosting Fox and Friends Weekend, a show on which Trump regularly appeared. Hegseth served in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Guantanamo Bay. Also nominated were South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem as Homeland Security Secretary, former Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe as CIA Director, Florida Rep. Michael Waltz as National Security Advisor, and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee as Ambassador to Israel. Republicans this morning elected South Dakota Senator John Thune as the new Senate Majority Leader, replacing longtime leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. Thune, a more traditional Republican in his fourth Senate term, has promised to work closely with incoming President Donald Trump, despite sometimes opposing him in the past. Thune publicly broke with Trump over his efforts to overturn the 2020 election, but in recent months has realigned himself with the former president. Thune's competitors in the secret ballot were Senators John Cornyn of Texas and Rick Scott of Florida. Scott ran a non-traditional bid for the Senate leadership position, winning endorsements from people outside the chamber, including Trump ally Elon Musk. Thune and Cornyn campaigned mostly within the Senate. The Biden administration said yesterday that it will not change its policy on arms transfers to Israel, after a deadline expired for Israel to allow more humanitarian aid into Gaza. In an October 13th letter, the Biden White House told Israel that it had to take specific steps to improve the aid situation within 30 days or face restrictions on U.S. military aid. Speaking to reporters, State Department Deputy Spokesperson Vedant Patel repeatedly declined to say if the criteria had been fulfilled, but also said Israel had taken steps to address the demands, and that Washington would continue to assess the situation. On Monday, 8 international aid groups said Israel had failed to meet the U.S. demands to improve access for assistance. A UN-backed report recently warned that there was an imminent likelihood of famine in northern Gaza, where hardly any aid has entered in the past month. And world leaders met yesterday in Azerbaijan for the beginning of the COP29 climate conference, though many key heads of state will not attend. Top leaders of the 13 largest greenhouse gas emitters will not attend, including the presidents of China and the United States. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres addressed the conference yesterday, warning world leaders they must act.
Excellencies, in these crucial periods, you and your governments must be guided by a clear truth. Climate finance is not charity, it's an investment. Climate action is not optional, it's an imperative. Both are indispensable to a livable world for all humanity and a prosperous future for every nation on Earth. The clock is ticking. I count on you, and I thank you.
Ilham Aliyev, president of host nation Azerbaijan, opened the conference by defending his country's oil and gas resource production, quote, because the market needs them. He said Azerbaijan would push for a green transition, quote, but at the same time, we must be realistic. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer was one of the notable climate-friendly leaders to make the conference, where he pledged an 81% emissions reduction over the next decade. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 50 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 46 degrees with fair skies. for WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York.